Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to a family when a child's potential is permanently diminished? In Akhil Sharma's new novel, a couple and their two sons emigrate from India to the United States with big dreams of prosperity, only to have their firstborn become profoundly disabled in a swimming pool diving accident a little more than a year after their arrival. Sharma was the second-born son of the real-life version of that family, and the novel is told from the perspective of that son, called Ajay in the novel. Ajay is about 10 when his brother Burju is injured and spends the rest of his own childhood with parents who have very little energy or attention left for him. Akhil Sharma's novel is called Family Life. Just today, it was named one of the New York Times' 100 notable books of 2014, and we are delighted that he could make time to talk with us about it. Akhil, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So I came to this novel knowing nothing about it, and I opened it expecting it to be a very interesting but sort of, you know, standard narrative about a family moving to a new country and adjusting to the culture. And then the bottom absolutely drops out when the character of Burju is hurt, and the story becomes something else entirely.
That was our experience as well, that we began thinking that our life in America was going to be this extraordinary thing, just because America is an extraordinary country, the greatest country in the world. And this tragedy occurred, this enormous misfortune, where my poor brother had his accident, and it changed everything.
Yeah, before this happens, you know, you're talking about how, like, your favorite things about America are TV and the library. There are these, like, resources of content that are so fascinating to you. Is it hard to remember back to the time before the accident changed everything?
Certain things are hard to remember, but, I mean, I remember my intense joy with America and my intense sense of seeing America as this romantic country. In India, because everything is so dry, seeing a body of water like a lake suggests enormous wealth. And I remember going to a park and seeing this little pond and feeling astonished by America. I remember getting into an elevator and being amazed that it would obey my instructions, you know, when I pressed a button and it would rise. So all these things I did remember because they were so intense.
I love the way that you convey, I guess, your excitement and in the book, Jay's excitement about moving, as he's boasting to his friends that when you travel on a plane, you can ask for anything you want from the flight attendant. And so your plan is to request a baby tiger.
That, maybe a baby dinosaur. You know, these were the, I remember the conversation we had, my brother and I, about that thing. Because we thought an airplane ticket is so expensive that surely you must get everything.
What was your relationship like as boys, and how did it change when you moved to the U.S. but before he was injured?
It was competitive. You know, my brother was older. I mean, I think in many families there's a rivalry between siblings, and there was one between me and my brother. After the but I was sort of busy with my own life. You know, I used to play cricket a lot. I was always outdoors. And so it was rivalry, but it wasn't anything tremendous. And then when I came to America, because I couldn't play sports, I felt much diminished, whereas my brother, who had always been the intellectual in the family, his life seemed to keep expanding. And I remember feeling a little bit envious, a little bit reduced around him. But I also began to appreciate, I had never really paid attention to the fact that he was so special. I had known that he was very smart, but I was very good at cricket. And I had thought being a good cricket player was more important than getting good grades. And so in America, I began to actually appreciate him more than I had in India.
When you first heard about the accident, and this book, we should say, is a novel but drawn from your own experiences. So if I'm assuming anything about you that is specific to Ajay or vice versa, I hope you'll point that out to me throughout the conversation. But when you first heard about the accident, before you knew how bad it was, your thought was, just for a moment, oh, great, maybe I get to be the only son and sort of get all the attention. And so it seems to me that just having that sort of normal, strange reaction left you with this really complex kind of survivor guilt later on.
I think it was that. But it was really the guilt came from later on, thinking about whether I would be willing to choose my, if I would be willing to swap positions with my brother. When I was right after the accident, I used to cry all the time in school. I would cry in school because I didn't want to cry at home and disturb my parents. So I would go start crying in class, and my teacher would send me outside, and I would walk around the schoolyard holding on to the fence, walk around and around until I got so exhausted that I would lie down in the dirt and go to sleep. And I remember once, and as I walked, I would talk to God, and I remember talking to him at some point and God asking me if I could switch places with Anoop, whether I would do so. And I immediately thought, I immediately thought no, and I immediately thought, oh, I'm not a good person. You know, I can't be trusted. And the guilt is not so much the fact that I survived, but the guilt is that I would not change places with him, that I'm glad it was him instead of me. That's the source of the guilt.
I mean, was there a time when you thought, when you came to recognize that just about anybody would feel that way? That you would comfort someone else by saying, well, of course that's natural, but you just couldn't accept that feeling for yourself?
You know, I didn't really discuss that, what had happened, with almost anyone until I was in my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So for me, I just grew up with that sense of guilt. And I think with my family, I love my parents. I adore them. But we're a family that's very concerned about outward appearances. And so it would not have been okay to say something like that. I think if I had said that, my mother would have been angry. You know, my mother would have not said that this was okay.
It is all the more poignant that we get to know your parents and their strengths and weaknesses and who they are as people before this accident changes them, because we have a glimpse of what they would have done and what they might have still struggled with, but in a very different context if your brother had not had his accident. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
I want to just say, preface all of this, that I adore my parents, and you know, they're my heart walking unprotected in the world. My father is a little bit depressive and a little bit cynical. It's hard for him to see anything that is benign. And my mother is a little bit manic and very not only just concerned with how the world sees us, but is also very certain that what she is doing is the right thing. And both of these things can be tremendous assets. You know, in India, if you approach everything with a bit of cynicism, that might help you survive, just because it's such a corrupt country. And with my mother, that certainty that she's right allowed her to just push forward in terms of taking care of my brother in the hospital and then taking care of him once we got home. So my brother died about 2 years ago. He had been sick for 30 years. And during that time, he never had a bed sore because she was just so committed to doing everything in the right way. You know, she was just so absolutely devoted to her sense of what is right or wrong and holding herself to that standard. So for me, she's heroic. I wish I were a little bit more like her.
On the other hand, she could not give up, and throughout the book that she, you know, invites in a sort of procession of faith healers and different people who claim that they can help your brother, who of course can't because he is just so badly injured, and she can't let herself give up on what is truly and sadly a hopeless situation, and it seems that maybe also made things more difficult for her.
You know, my mother, what happened to my brother was that the oxygen deprivation caused brain damage. My mother, who's very pious, was convinced that God could fix him, because she felt that if God is omnipotent, why should he not be able to fix this as well? And she was willing. She didn't so much. She had all these miracle workers come to the house, but she didn't actually believe it was the miracle workers that would be helping her, helping us, but that her behavior would show, would testify to God, her faith, and would shame him into waking my brother, into fixing him. And so it's hard when you're that religious to, you know, even if she were to accept the fact that he is brain damaged, right? That he is, that he is like a TV that's burnt out from the inside. Even if she were to believe that, her religious faith would not then say, would then say, well, okay, so he's this way, but God can fix this as well. And the fact that she saw the world in this way did limit the other possibilities that she was willing to allow.
The other thing that's really interesting about this story is that the standard narrative of assimilation for immigrants, at least for your parents, gets so pushed out of the way by this new situation that it's almost not even relevant for them anymore. Am I correct about that?
I mean, I think that the standard narrative of assimilation covers generations, whereas this covers only a period of years, and so it shows some adjustment. So it shows Indians when they have just arrived, and during that period when you're feeling so out of place, you actually become more conservative, more committed to your Indianness, and that was what they experienced. The other thing that occurred with my family is that they were viewed as heroic. They were admired. And because they were admired for being very Indian. The sacrifice that they made was seen as a sacrifice that was that made the Indian community look good. And so we became more Indian in response to that. So for example, whereas many children, when they spoke, many people who grew up in America would refer to the days of the week using English names, you know, Saturday, Sunday. I would use the Hindi names, you know, Shanivar, Itvar, because it seemed important to signal that we were very Indian, because that was part of how we drew respect or affection or interest from the community. And all of that affection and interest from the community was part of what sustained us. And so there is, you know, the typical narrative would be slow adjustment and absorption into the country. But if you were to slow that down, the first reaction to coming to America is you become more Indian, or you become more of whatever your community is. In our case, that period got extended, and we became more Indian, more conservative for decades.
You say that the admiration of the community sustained your family. Was it also, did it feel like a burden to have to live like exemplars?
Everything was such a burden that, you know, this seemed like the least thing possible. You know, when you're taking care of a sick person every day and you're waking up at 5:30 in the morning to take him to a bathtub and bathe him, the saying Shanivar Itwar is a minor thing. So, it, you know, I noticed that I was playing a role. I wished I were something else, that I wished I had a slightly more authentic way of living, but it didn't matter that much to me.
My guest is author Akhil Sharma. His new novel, Family Life, has just been named today to the New York Times list of 100 notable books of 2014. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Akhil Sharma about his novel Family Life. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Akhil, what were the challenges for you of describing this very debilitating injury of your brother's and condition of your brother's in a way that would allow readers to understand its gravity and its indignities, but not venture into something that was like distractingly grotesque?
Because we've been talking about the subject matter of the book, it seems very grim. And the subject matter is grim, but I don't think the book is. I think the book is full of life. And one way to handle it, one way to make it possible to make the book attractive to readers was just filling it full of life and comedy. So, for example, very early in the novel, when I introduce these characters, when I introduce the father, I have the young boy, Ajay, say, "When I was a child, I thought my father had been assigned to us by the government. This was because he appeared to serve no purpose." And so filling the book full of humor and then filling the book full of closely observed life, the delightfulness of strange people, the strange miracle workers, or the tenderness that the family sometimes shows towards each other, that was how I managed that balance between a book that is respectful to the reality of such an experience. I'm sure that many people have dealt with illness in their families, and just the how unbearable it can be, physically unbearable it can be. And many people have dealt with it, and everyone will deal with it at some point. And so recognizing the truth of that and then blending it with the things that make life pleasurable.
There's a wonderful scene early in the book when you describe your mother's frugality, when you're still in India, and she will buy a box of matches and then hand them to you and your brother with a razor blade and have you split them down the center so you can use them twice.
Another thing that we used to do in India back then, and India in the 70s was much poorer than it is now, is the pill bottles, medicine that came in the form of pills. We would take out the cotton and save that cotton and use it to make wicks and things like that for prayer ceremonies.
When you arrived at school, how were you received by the other children in your class? Were you the only immigrant student in your class initially?
In my memory is that I was the only immigrant. I can't know for sure. I do remember meeting an Indian from Trinidad at some point and feeling bad for him because he didn't seem truly Indian. So that was that's the only immigrant that I remember. Again, you have to remember that India, America in the 1970s was very different than it is now. The immigration laws were changed in 1965, and it was only in the 80s that the real wave of immigration began. It started a little bit in the 70s, but the real change began to come about in the 80s.
I love the fact that in the book, as you mentioned, there are moments of joy. It's also always clear that your brother is loved. Even, you know, the teasing that the family does of him seems to me very benign and sweet. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We used to call my brother and the characters also tease and make fun of the injured boy. So we used to call my brother Kumkaran, which is this mythological figure who sleeps 6 months of the year. We used to call him lazy and fat. And it was done for two reasons. For multiple reasons. One was that whenever we made a loud noise, which is how we would tease. We would tease him by shouting little things at him. He would jerk. And that was a way of pretending that he could hear, you know, because he could respond to sound. The other thing was by pointing out By claiming that he was just lazy or that he, by teasing him, we could pretend that he was normal. And so this was a way of, denying reality. And it was a way of, you know, what, it's hard to know how one behaves with loyalty in a situation like this. You know, what is the, how do I show my love for this person? And it seemed to me, and it seemed to my poor parents, that the only way to show love, to show loyalty, was by pretending that he was unchanged, or to the extent that he was changed, we were still committed to preserving him or protecting him.
It does seem, and I thought while reading this story, that it's just a really complicated grieving process, right? Because I'm sorry to hear that your brother died 2 years ago. In many ways, it had been 30 years since he had been the person that you had known him as. His body was still there. He was there in a different form and needed your love and your care, but he was not the same person exactly.
Yeah, it was strange, though. After he died, I missed him so much that I thought, oh, I would take him back, sick as he is. Hmm. You know, the character at one point, this Ajay, the protagonist, is thinking about his brother's dying, and he suddenly feels such love, and he thinks, oh, you know, the people who have sick relatives are lucky. The people who have injured relatives are lucky because at least they have this person to love. And we love, you know, to some extent, we love our love as much as we love the person who is gone. I loved my grief because my grief had him in it. You know, there's that famous thing by Shakespeare when the king says to the queen, oh, you know, you grieve too much, you're crying too much. And she said, oh, my grief walks, her son had died. And she says, you know, my grief walks beside me. It prattles in his pretty tongue being his son's voice. It stuffs itself into my boy's clothes. If you had grief like mine, would you not love it too? And so we love our grief because this grief contains the person that we have lost.
Did it surprise you to miss him as much as you did?
No, it didn't surprise me. You know, I think as you get older, you begin to realize that you think you know you love people. You think you know you love them a certain amount, but you actually love them vastly more. So it didn't surprise me.
That's like the best thing about love, right?
Yeah. It opens up all these parts of you that you didn't know.
So in the book, the father, and I gather in real life, your father develops a pretty serious drinking problem throughout the years of your youth. And on top of this being like troublesome for the family, within the Indian immigrant community where you were living, this was a shame just beyond almost anything else.
In reality, my father is not an alcoholic. In reality, alcoholism in the Indian community is something of shame. It's something that people hide. It's the same way that they hide mental illness. So, in the novel and in the community, it's something that if this problem exists, you hide it. Now, many of my readers have come to me and told me that they suffer with this in their family, this need to keep this secret.
Why do you think is it more taboo than other problems? I mean, is there something specific about like the use of intoxicants that is just, you know, really hard to talk about?
I mean, many things are taboo. So violence against women is not something people talk about, or against children, or sexual abuse, or, or alcohol or drugs. So it's one of many taboos, many of the things that they don't talk about. And partially they don't talk about it because they believe, and I believe, and I think accurately, that the community will judge them harshly. The community, both in India and in America, will judge them harshly. And I think partially they don't talk about it because they don't know what to do, what the solution might be.
Ajay talks to God a lot in the early years in the United States, and God talks back to him in a way that feels very real. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And you described a similar experience that you had yourself of feeling that God was speaking to you.
Yes. So Ajay is originally, the logic of having the God sections were the accident has occurred. In the chapter, Ajay is going to grow conscious of the fact that things are never going to change. And so we have to figure out a way to mark his growing awareness. The easiest way to mark it would be to show the same thing occurring over and over, but as it recurs, it's each time it is slightly different. And so that slight difference will mark the growing awareness. So when I was thinking that, I was thinking, well, what can I use to do that, which will be strange enough that'll hide the nature of the device that I'm using? So I had him begin to talk to God. So that was the logic of using him, having that device there. I personally also talked, my family is very religious, and I would, I used to talk to God all the time. I would pray all the time. My parents pray 4 or 5 times a day. So this is a religion is a very important and large part of their lives.
Do they see that prayer as like simply a form of communication, or is it about asking for what you need, or is it about praise, or a combination of those things?
In some ways, it's bribery. Like, you know, I offer you, God, this prayer so that you might not hurt me. Right? That might be one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is to say that, you know, I do my part, right? I do my part of doing praying. You know, I do my part in terms of being an honest person or a good person. And if bad things occur, they occur, you know, but it's not my fault. At least I've taken care of my side of the street. So that might be another way of thinking of it. And then a third way might be, you know, you pray, and as you pray, you are connected to all the other people who pray. And so you become connected to the wider human experience. You know, I'm praying and so are millions of other people. And so we're all part of this shared humanity. So that is still another way of benefiting from praying.
You worked on this novel for more than 12 years. Is that right?
12 and a half years. I feel like I shattered my youth against this book.
Do you feel like you had to do it, or you couldn't have progressed to doing anything else?
No. I tend not to think like that. For me, it was just sort of this terrible mistake that I made, thinking I would be able to write this book easily in 2, 3, 4 years. And then at a certain point, you begin thinking, well, I've invested this much time. Let me try a little bit more. And then at a certain point, you realize you've invested so much that you can't back out of it without having a nervous breakdown. It was just a terrible mistake. I mean, knowing everything I know now, I wouldn't have written this book.
Because it took so much time and effort.
Yes, because it took so much time and effort. You know, a friend of mine, a really nice guy, told me that he began dating a woman. And soon after they started dating, within a few months, she learned that she had cancer. And so he began going with her to her doctor's appointments, and he remained with her. Because he felt that, you know, that was the right thing to do, to be helpful to her. And so he was there with her when the hospital bed arrived, and he assembled the bed, and he was there with her, you know, when she was setting up a schedule for nurses to take care of her. And then he was there holding her hand when she died. And he said that, you know, I never really liked this woman that much. You know, I just felt that this was the right thing to do. And he said that I'm glad that somebody was there with her. I'm glad that somebody took care of her when she was sick. I just wish I hadn't been the poor schnook who did it. And that's sort of my view of this book. You know, like, I'm touched by the comfort it has brought people, and I'm glad, you know, that it's a real privilege to be able to do something that's helpful. You know, it's a great privilege to be able to do that. I just wish I hadn't been the poor guy who did that.
7,000 pages, ultimately, you wrote before finding the 218 in the finished book.
Yep.
How different are the many iterations of what
you
created?
They're completely different. I mean, this is first person. I spent 5 or 6 years in a third-person narrative. I wrote it from the point of view of the mother, the father, a floating third-person point of view. There were certain stories that were much more fully developed, like the father's alcoholism. Many things were different. There were versions that were 400 pages. I mean, complete drafts. There was a period when the book was basically done. There was a period when my British editor, felt very concerned for me at what I had gotten myself into. And he said, "Akhil, just send me the book. Send me what you have, and we'll work on it together." So I sent it to him, and he went through it, and he said, "You know, this is fine. You know, there's some minor changes I would suggest, but it's a fine book." And I think it was an okay draft, but it was such a dark book that I don't think it would have been a book that writers read. I don't think it would be a book that that general readers would read. It wouldn't have been helpful the way that I wished this book to be helpful. And so that was 3 or 4 years before the book was finally done.
At that point, I mean, when you've put so much into it, can you trust yourself to know that you've done the one that is what you want?
There's certain effects that I'm reaching for. One is that sense of irresistibility, that if you begin the book, you can't stop reading it. Another is this effect of luminescence, that if you begin reading the book, you're in the world. A third is this sense of effortlessness, you know, that when something occurs, the reader thinks, oh, it is occurring. You know, that it's not fiction. It doesn't feel like fiction. And so those effects, I can tell, are occurring. So that's what I was aiming for. I believe that the book contains flaws, you know. I believe that there are things I would fix if I were to do it again. But I was just seeking those certain effects.
We're speaking with author Akhil Sharma about his new book, Family Life. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Akhil Sharma about his novel Family Life, which just today was named one of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of 2014. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Akhil, at any point in the writing process, did you consider putting yourself as a writer inside the head of your brother and imagining that he was sort of conscious and experiencing any of this for himself in a way that we could relate to?
I thought about raising the level of his sentience. I mean, that I considered. In fact, I had a draft with that. I spent time thinking about what it must be like for him to be inside. You know, there's an image that I had of him being like a miner trapped in a collapsed seam, and us, all the effort we were doing, being similar to us, just tapping on the outside, letting him know he's not alone. So I did spend some time thinking about it. I felt that doing so would make the narrative much more traditional, and so I backed away from it. Traditional and obvious is what I meant.
It has to be tempting when the events so closely mirror things that you've experienced to at least imagine a happy ending.
Um, there is a happy ending in that the child gets out, Ajay gets out.
Yeah.
The idea of a happy ending, like a simple happy ending, never occurred to me. Because it just didn't seem proper, you know, it didn't seem honest. It would be, you know, part of loving somebody is loving them with all their faults, and part of loving people is seeing their suffering. So the idea of taking away their suffering would have felt like a betrayal.
When you work on something for this long and you have a variety of different drafts, I mean, is there anyone who has seen them all other than you?
No, not all of them. I mean, all those thousands of pages. I mean, my editor had saw probably 5 or 6 different drafts, and she was very, very kind and very patient. But even she didn't see all of them.
Are you still as compelled to write as ever after this experience that turned out to be so hard?
I don't know if I could. Right now, I can't bear the idea of writing another novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't have the stamina. So I'm working on some short stories. I'm thinking about writing this nonfiction book, but not a novel. That frightens me.
You didn't start out professionally as a novelist.
No, I was an investment banker for a while, and I did that not for very long, for like 3 years, and then I quit. It wasn't for me.
Were you always sure, like when you were being an investment banker, did you think if only I could write full time, then I would be happy?
No, I mean, what I felt was I wished I enjoyed this thing more. Because I really wanted to love being a banker. I really wanted to enjoy that career. I didn't want to be a writer. For me, you know, I don't want to read menus right to left. And that was never my goal. My goal was to lead a comfortable middle class, upper middle class life, and that's why I wanted to be a banker. And the unfortunate thing, or the fortunate thing, is that for me, my interior life and the life of words and books and what a novel can represent has always seemed the most important thing.
We have an email here from Eden who wants to know why you chose fiction over memoir to tell this story.
There are certain things which are hard to, you know, I wanted to use dialogue, and I can't honestly say that I remember what people said at various points. I did not want to write about certain things. I didn't want to write about boredom, for example, because if I did, much of my childhood was boring, and I didn't want to write about that, even though that was a large part of my childhood. So if I were writing nonfiction, I feel like there was an obligation to not do certain things, so not use dialogue, and there was an obligation to do certain things, include material which was important, which was relevant, but which I found completely uninteresting. And so I chose to do what I felt would capture the intensity of the experience that I endured, that my family endured.
It's interesting because it occurred to me that there must have been a lot of, like, you know, frequent visits to the doctor with your brother and, you know, going to the pharmacy for medication. And the novel sort of stripped clean of all that. We have the sense that it's going on in the background somewhere, but it doesn't ever really encroach on the action and within the story itself.
Yes. I mean, almost everything that was constantly going on, delivery of medical supplies or my brother getting pneumonia and being taken to the hospital or the G-tube, the gastrointestinal tube coming out, and, you know, just various horrifying things that occurred around then, or other medical stuff. And it is touched upon, but it's not made, it is not fully realized. Because if you begin to do that, then the book begins to make other demands.
When Ajay does decide to share with some classmates like what the situation is at home, things are, turn out rather disastrous after a while. Like he tells them, and then he starts to exaggerate the stories, and then finally he's alienated these kids that might have otherwise been his friends. Did you have an experience that was similar to that yourself?
Similar. I mean, I didn't tell people about my brother. I told them other lies. A friend of mine from elementary school, from sixth grade, from the period that that chapter covers, I spoke to him, or I exchanged some emails with him, and he said that he had no idea that that I had a brother or that my brother had been injured in this way. So the facts of that did not occur, but the emotions and the idea of trying to, how do you talk about this thing in an honest way, did occur. Like, when we would meet people, when my family would meet people, and they would say that my brother was in a coma, when obviously he was not in a coma, he was just severely brain damaged. Or the fact that my people would lie about my family because they couldn't understand what had actually happened, and so they would praise us in an extravagant way. And I didn't really understand why this was going on. And so all these small lies were a part of our life. So that occurred.
Did you feel like that praise was another sort of, you know, I don't know, bribery of God or bargaining? Like, if you can look at someone else who is suffering outside of your, you know, immediate circle and say, well, you're so brave and so special, it's almost like telling yourself, this can never happen to me and my family.
I don't know if the praise we received was motivated by that. I think a lot of it was motivated by this, you know, you see somebody who is in tremendous pain and you want to offer comfort, and there's almost nothing you can do, you know, and so you offer this little thing that you can offer, which is words. The other thing is that there were some people who really showed up for us, who would come to, you know, who would do things like come to my parents' house and take me shopping for school supplies, or who would come regularly. And they would show up in a very practical way. And then there were other people who did not want to be around my brother, around that suffering, and so would merely offer praise. So both things occurred, you know, just genuine sympathy and so speaking out of that sympathy, and then praise as a simple way of doing, as a substitute, as counterfeit currency for work you don't want to do, and which you feel somehow morally compelled to do because here is somebody suffering in front of you.
It doesn't come up so much in a direct way in the novel itself, but it made me think a lot about Ajay, the son who is, you know, healthy and really dutiful and sort of there as much as possible for his brother and his parents, could never quite be enough to fill that void that existed because of the accident of Birju. And I wonder about the extent to which you sort of put that in the subtext of the novel itself, or that you might have felt that as a child growing up.
You know, it's impossible to substitute one thing for another. You know, there are no perfect substitutes. And so there is a desire. There was a simple desire on my parents' part for me to make up for what they were enduring. But obviously that doesn't work. And so instead of realizing that, you know, there are no substitutes, there was instead a sense of disappointment or failure that did occur. And there was a part of me that wanted to make up for what had occurred for my brother and feeling failure as well, because I couldn't make up for it. You know, many people would come and, you know, this misunderstanding, this basic misunderstanding of life occurred with everyone. I know that many people would come and offer affection to us, and I would feel almost angry because I would think, you know, you're saying that you care about us, but if you care about us, why don't you fix this situation? Why don't you remove me from this pain? And so feeling that people were lying when they were telling me how sad they felt for me because I wanted something else, and I was misunderstanding their affection as a substitute for them wanting things for wanting to make me okay. I'm not sure if I'm speaking clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm wondering about whether you just, you know, you describe that anger like that they can't really help you or take you out of this pain. Did you resent people around you who seemed to care about you but had pretty uncomplicated home lives?
I don't know, you know, because I was growing up with this. To some extent, I thought that I had an ordinary life. I mean, it was hard for me to understand what an unusual life it was. Did I resent it? To some extent, but not tremendously. And, I mean, I had my misfortunes, but I also felt very fortunate, you know. I was okay. It's really hard to dislike somebody or feel resentful for other people's good fortune when you feel that, hey, you escaped this bullet that your brother took.
Yeah.
So that was not a large part of my life or my consciousness.
What, I mean, I would think many authors, when they've worked for a long time on a novel, are so excited to finally get a hard copy in their hands and hold it. This one seems to, I mean, I know you're very proud of the work, but at the same time, it represents a lot of time and a lot of pain and a lot of effort. What did it feel like for you when you received a copy that you could hold in your hand?
You know, I didn't. It was, I mean, for a long time, even after the book was done, I kept having nightmares that I would have to continue working on it. So that continued for a while. I haven't read any of the reviews, other than one review. I haven't read any of the reviews. The various lists of best books of the year are being announced. So the New York Times came out today. Huffington Post came out today. There's some other ones that are going to come out, which I've learned about. And, you know, because I've not been engaged with the machinery of, you know, the book's distribution and reception, in some ways, for me, fortunately, the book seems behind me. I feel like I've already moved on to other things. You know, I'm glad that the book is out there in the world, but it's not a large part of my life right now.
I suppose I should have asked this before we invited you, but is it horrible for you to talk about it?
No. In fact, I just did an interview this morning with an Italian reporter. So it's something that I talk about, but it's not, you know, it's just not a large part of my life or my thoughts.
My guest has been author Akhil Sharma. His new novel is called Family Life. It's made the New York Times list of 100 notable novels for 2014. Akhil, I really enjoyed the book and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.